This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of tane, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos? We can construct and nurture community, or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have Anna Daniels. How do you pronounce your name, Anna?
It's Anne Daniels, but that's fine. I like Anna.
Okay, Anne Daniels, president of the New Zealand Nurses Organization, who became, early in her career, her sense of justice led her to become the New Zealand Nurses Organization delegate and then convener of the Thames Hospital, and led nurses through opposing the government funding cuts and reduction of services. Looks like history might be repeating itself.
Unfortunately.
You can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz and then going to podcasts, and then going to Community or Chaos. Could you briefly talk about the nurses' organization?
Yes, Marvin. The New Zealand Nurses' Organization has been around for quite a long time. The actual background to that was born in the sort of late 1800s, but it only became an organization in the early 1990s, and currently we now have 60,000 members or more, and we are the biggest single union in New Zealand, made up of nurses, midwives, nurse practitioners, healthcare assistants who work in public health, primary health, aged care, and the funded sector. So yeah, that's us in a nutshell.
All right. New Zealand hospitals understaffed, and how does understaffing affect care for hospital patients?
Yes, the hospitals are very much understaffed. Just recently, last week on Thursday, we held rallies right around the country to highlight the public and also to try and get the government to understand that they need to fund the health sector a hell of a lot better than they are doing now. And the reason for that is that under the Official Information Act, we were able to release some information about how understaffed we were. So what we found was that 25% of all the nursing shifts in the public hospitals were below, say, staffing targets. And unfortunately, some wards were understaffed all the time. So some examples of that was that the Auckland District accounted for 1/3 of the understaffed shift last year. And to put a number on that, that was 54,830 shifts in 2023 that did not have enough staff to provide safe care. Capital Coast and Hutt Valley was the single district reporting the highest number of shifts below target, and that was 22,000 shifts in a year. And of the 540 wards that Te Whatu Ora hospitals have, nearly 1/5 of those wards were understaffed 50% of the time. So just imagine going to work knowing that, you know, and we use text these days, so the charge nurse will text you, and knowing that half the staff that you know should be on duty aren't going to be there, and the kind of shift that you're going to face, knowing that you're not going to be able to do a safe job, provide care in a safe and timely manner in the way it should be done, is what you're facing before you go on duty. And that takes a real toll on the nurses and doctors that actually go to work every day. So not surprisingly, the mental health wards experienced the highest level of understaffing throughout the New Zealand, 90% of the time in Waitemata and Capital Coast and Hutt Valley. And in children's wards, they were understaffed 50% of the time. Surgical wards, 56%. Women's health, 37%. And I know that last year there was, Te Whatu Ora itself did a survey of staff to ask how they were feeling about their work. And two-thirds of them, all staff, reported that they didn't have the time, budget, people or resources to do their job safely or in a timely way. So this problem is huge.
Does this contribute to wait times in accident and emergency?
Yes, it does. But more importantly, it affects the patient because, you know, right now the government has set 5 health targets, which are just absolutely not going to be met because we don't have the staff or the resources to do that. And we absolutely need a safe staffing. So the New Zealand Nurses Organisation is calling for legislated nurse-patient ratios that incorporate and prioritises culturally safe care. And this is unique throughout the world. And the reason why we're doing that is because successive governments have failed the health professionals and not providing enough funding, not thinking about long-term strategies instead of short-term, not making sure that we're recruiting enough of our own nurses and doctors and retaining them in this country. You know, turnover is a huge cost, but it directly affects our patients. Our patients have poorer health outcomes because they have to wait for care. Or they don't get that care at all because they can't afford to go to the GP or they have to wait for far too long in the emergency department.
We've been underfunding healthcare for a long time, haven't we, since the 90s?
Yes, we have. There's lots of statistics thrown around about funding. And that worries me because people keep talking about money, but they don't talk about the people who need the care and the people that we're failing. We don't hear very often about how many patients are being affected in their lives and their future because they're not getting the care they need. And when patients don't get the care they need when they need it, that costs the health system even more. So prevention is absolutely key to this, and the PIORA Act is has aspirations to turn a medical model health system into one where we concentrate on prevention and health instead. So, you know, it's very, very important from a funding point of view that we actually talk about the cost of harm, of delayed care, of the things that are not being funded that cause problems further down the line, instead of short-term thinking about how much money can we actually save to reduce the budget, which, you know, to be perfectly honest, I'm very fearful that the government, this coalition government, is thinking about keeping the funding levels in our health system as the status quo rather than increasing them markedly, so we can retain the nurses and the doctors and the health professionals we need, particularly in primary health care and aged care, to actually reduce the pressures on hospitals and emergency departments.
Does the government have contradictory goals. They want to reduce taxes in one case, and they also set goals for health care and other public services.
Yes, they do. They want to save money. I'm not sure why, because saving money in the health system often equates to poorer health outcomes and huger pressures on the hospitals and primary health care.
Following the economic model that we've had for the last 30 or 40 years, and it's I'm not sure it's worked out well for New Zealand.
I think the tax funding system actually needs to be changed, and it's not equitable at the moment. For instance, everybody pays tax, even those who are earning $19,000 in a year. The disadvantaged, the low income, the disabled, people who are least able to pay taxes, I believe shouldn't be taxed at all. I think that there should be a tax threshold that you can see in some countries. So people who are badly disadvantaged shouldn't pay tax at all. And I also think that tax should be levied on people's ability to pay. The mum and dad and the middle income are paying most of the tax in this country. And unfortunately, those who can actually pay more are often paying less than somebody who's on $19,000 a year. And that's not fair. It's not equitable. And it certainly isn't lending itself to adequate funding in the health system, where we've got enough nurses, doctors and health professionals, particularly in primary health care and aged care, to provide the preventative care that's necessary to take the pressures off our hospitals and our ED.
In your experience with healthcare and healthcare institutions, do we actually need to increase taxation, especially on those who can afford to pay taxes and corporations,
Absolutely.
In order to keep our infrastructures going? Or are we likely to fall into a greater crisis if things continue as they are?
Yeah. Well, I suppose I'm going to take a step back from that question, because you asked, do we need taxes to keep the current infrastructures going? I'm not sure that we need to keep the current infrastructures going. I think that we need to actually turn our medical model, healthcare system, one of health, so that we can actually teach our people how to keep themselves well and walk alongside them in that journey. But, it goes back to some very, very basic factors. We know that poor health comes from poor housing that is not dry, that is not warm, and poor a diet. People who are disadvantaged with low incomes cannot buy good, healthy fruit and vegetables and meat on a regular basis. So those two things are very important. Being able to be educated and have really good opportunities to earn higher incomes is another. These are all called social determinants of health. And we have known for a very, very long time that having a warm house to live in will reduce markedly the number of people who attend during the winter with respiratory complaints, asthma and pneumonia. So there are things that can be done from a preventative point of view that will reduce all these pressures on hospitals. And these can be delivered in our communities by focusing on health as opposed to illness.
Doesn't this require, actually, if you look at the countries where you don't have a housing crisis, where you have warm housing, where you have a free education system through university, they pay higher taxes, and the wealthy also pay much higher taxes. If you want low taxes, you have to probably put up with what we've got. So don't we actually need to change the tax system?
Yes, we absolutely do need to change the tax system. But I'll just be qualify myself here. I am not a tax expert by any means. But I am a mother and a wife who's run a household with children and grandchildren. And I know that if you have a certain income, you have to stay within that income or you go into debt. So it makes absolute sense that the tax that I would pay to a government needs to be at a level that I can afford to pay. And those who can afford to pay more should pay more. In New Zealand, I like to think that we are very community-minded, but unfortunately, the issues that were identified through our COVID period showed that isn't really the case. We need to have a philosophy that we live in a country where we actually care for each other. And to do that, those who can actually do more should do more, rather than actually keep their funds to themselves, for themselves. I think it's very, very important that we are community-minded and take pride in the idea that we're all contributing to the health and well-being of each other. And this is one of the reasons why I really feel comfortable with Māori and Pacifica ways of community mindedness. They put family and hapū and iwi first before the individual. And that kind of philosophy, I think, needs to be totally embedded within the New Zealand way of life. And we can do that if we honour the Te Tiriti o Waitangi, which is our founding document in New Zealand. There needs to be a will about this so that we can make it happen.
There's been surveys recently about how much trust there is in politicians and governments. And unfortunately, trust has gone down considerably. And one of the reasons, perhaps, for the lack of trust is that people don't feel like the governments have been governing in their interest and that New Zealand hasn't been working as well as it could.
No, I totally agree with that, and I'm not surprised by the results of the survey. I was interested in, and I know that might be a little bit naive at my age and stage, but I recently looked up what governments were supposed to do, and it was very, very clear. Governments are supposed to work for the benefit of the people, not for the benefit of themselves and their old boys club. And I'm getting quite concerned that that might be the way things are going. And it came to mind because very recently, the idea that the coalition government is going to sign off on big projects without going through due process to make sure that any big buildings, like new hospitals, for instance, are going to be built in the right place that doesn't disadvantage people, that they are going to be built in the right way with all the safety features that are necessary and future-proofed. I do have to wonder exactly who this government is actually governing for, because right now it does not seem to be for the people. The vast majority of us who are in the tax brackets that don't allow us to do anything but struggle every day to actually pay the rent and put food on the table. And now, of course, the added pressure of actually being made redundant and not being able to get jobs. I have got huge empathy for those who are going through those processes right now.
It seems to me counterproductive to think of unemployment as good for the economy. But that's just my personal
view. I agree with you. Those who can't earn and cannot pay their rent and cannot put good food on the table and can't afford to rent a house that's warm and dry are going to get sick. And that is going to actually take a toll on the hospitals and primary health care. It's going to cost a lot more in the long run. And long term, it's going to affect those individuals with all the stress and hurt and fear that they have to endure for their families, their children, and what the future might look like. I don't see any sense in it just to bring down the inflation rate. I mean, for most of us, the inflation rate is a very theoretical concept, but for those of us who are losing their jobs, losing their homes and not being able to eat, it's not theoretical at all.
Does, going back to medical practice, does stress on private practice and the cost of doctor visits encourage an overuse of accident and emergency services?
And yes, it does. Absolutely. I can speak to that myself because I've worked in a hospital, a city-based ED for over 13 years and a rural ED for another 10 years before that. And it is very, very clear to us that even at the best of times when you've got fully funded, adequately funded GP services in the community, we don't have good after-hour services throughout the country, and so people have to go to EDs after hours in the first place. But now we've got GPs who are shutting their doors because they don't have enough nurses and doctors to provide the level of care for their patients they already have on their books, let alone the ones that are trying to get into GP services. Primary health is the opportunity for us to keep people well in our country. So it makes no sense not to fund it appropriately, not to increase the number of nurse practitioners, nurse prescribers, district nurses, school nurses in the community to keep us well. It is an absolute no-brainer, but I know that the GPs and the practice nurses have been fighting for appropriate funding and a funding model that will allow them to do this for many years. And I am hoping that this coalition government will do right by primary health and aged care. But given the last 6 months of government of cutting costs and changing legislation that is going to further disadvantage the healthcare system and the people that need it, I am not particularly hopeful.
I'm going to play a piece of music and then we'll come back.
Okay.
Can't remember the last time I took in this view. Hills spilling green, sky shining blue. Where the creek used to run down its water-worn course, it's now just a big yellow paddock of gorse. Where the house used to be, just a chimney stack stands, and all the hard work of my grandfather's hands. Dikes and the gardens against nature's force. It's now just a big yellow paddock of gorse. The bush and the birds once covered this land. Great rivers that twisted their way to the sand have all given way to the grasslands and dams for the big yellow prophet, butter and lamb. Falling fellow at man's heavy hand. Prices are down, and so is demand. No point in trying to flog a dead horse. Just let it lie in a paddock of gorse. It's just a big yellow paddock of gorse in bloom. Hedges of hawthorn and ditches of broom. Everywhere you look, there's no more room. It's just a big yellow paddock of gorse. I remember a time we looked out for each other. Neighbour for neighbour and sister for brother. Now it's each for his own and it's all getting worse. Nobody's clearing that paddock of gorse. Now the rat's settling in and he's counting his cash. The brownfields of Christchurch aren't looking too flash. Toad of Toad Hall says it's par for the course. You're left with a big yellow paddock of gorse. It's just a big yellow paddock of gorse in bloom. Hedges of hawthorn, ditches of broom. Everywhere you look there's no more room. It's just a big yellow paddock of gorse. Just a big yellow paddock of gorse in bloom. Hedges of hawthorn, ditches of broom. Everywhere you look there's no more room. Just a big yellow paddock of gorse.
Well, that was a big yellow paddock of gorse, a kind of analogy or of what's going on in New Zealand in a sense by Catgut and Steel. We're talking with Anne Daniels, president of the New Zealand Nurses Organization, about healthcare in New Zealand. Do you think there's enough solidarity on pay and conditions among healthcare professionals?
Yeah. He is now very prevalent within all the different health professions. And I've been a nurse for over 40 years, and it's only in the last year to 18 months that I have seen evidence of the solidarity. So recently the doctors went out on strike, and the senior doctors about 6 months ago, and nurses and other health professionals joined them on the picket line. And the reverse is true. When we had our rallies on Thursday, the doctors came and joined us and encouraged us to stand strong. We're also very, very we work closely together, and from a union perspective as well, because our issues are very, very similar. We need to retain the doctors and nurses that we have here in New Zealand and the other health professionals, and we need to recruit people as well. So we need to have good education systems with enough places that will ensure that the gaps that we have now and in the that we're predicting we will have in the future with the ageing workforce and the ageing population will be filled. So definitely we have solidarity, and we work together very, very closely in terms of the messaging that we give to government and health employers about making sure that we have enough nurses, doctors and health professionals to do the job in a safe and a timely manner.
Does keeping and having enough health workers, that's a long-term thing, isn't it? If, for instance, if the government had decided to make training and education and healthcare free, or maybe some kind of bond afterward, would that work better keeping the professional going and making sure we had enough professional people to do the job?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because there already is a bonding system in place and it's not working. We have done research. Our New Zealand Nurses Organisation student unit and another entity called Paid Placements have done a lot of research around this. And they have found consistent results, and that is that nurses who have to, let's just use nurses for instance, nurse students who have to go away to do what they call clinical placements, they need to travel to those quite often. And they have to pay for their own accommodation to actually attend those paid placements that might be out of town. For instance, somebody who's living in Dunedin might have to go to Oamaru or Timaru or into the rural sector. Now, these students have gotten part-time jobs, most of them do. So when they're away at their paid placements, they can't work and bring in the income. But they're having to pay two lots of rent, the petrol and everything else.
But so, they have to pay these things because education is a user pay system now. Is user pay the best form of education to have?
Well, I like the idea of user pays because, you know, if we had a user pay system in our health system and it became very much like the American system, for instance, we know that it would fail completely. So if you actually need nurse resource and nurses in your system to provide healthcare, and let's just be very clear, it is the nurses who are at the bedside in the homes and the communities that are there 24/7. It is not the doctors or any other health professional. It's the nurses who provide that care. If we need more nurses, then we actually have to support them to actually complete their training. Right now, over a third of our new students cannot complete their training simply because they cannot put petrol in the car, pay their rent, and put food on the table, let alone study and work full time.
Well, what I'm proposing is that countries that have free education, where you don't have to pay to get training, where you may actually be helped to a certain extent, might work better for the health system in the long run, and maybe for the whole economy.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. In fact, just this week, one of the states in Australia have announced a living wage for new students of about $390 or $400 a week in recognition of the fact that nurses cannot be cope with having to work full-time, study full-time. And a lot of them are mature students with families and have children, et cetera, and competing priorities to do this. So they have announced that they are going to provide what looks like a living wage, but is a stipend of sorts. In New Zealand, if you are a male apprentice of learning to be an electrician or a builder, you get a similar sort of pay. Police get paid $60,000 over their training time. Nurses get nothing. They get absolutely nothing. They can apply for a bond after they've completed their training and get some money paid back, but most of the attrition occurs in the second and third years. So that's where we need to actually focus our attention. We must have a similar system to the one that Australia has just put in and recognise that we need more nurses and we need our student nurses to succeed, not fail.
I've had experience in the dental school of actually being a patient, but I know that I know that sometimes professors there feel worried about failing students, especially foreign students, because it's so expensive to become a dentist. And you get a loan. And then when you finish, you have to pay that loan back. And if you're a specialist or a dentist, well, you're going to try to pay that loan back. You're going to try to you may find yourself having to raise the fees to pay the loan. And once the loan's paid back, are you going to lower your fees? Does it make sense to cost so much, to charge people so much for education? Does it make sense to make education something we pay for in that way?
Well, we used to have what we called a free education system. I'm not sure how free it was, but it was relatively free. And it encouraged people to continue their education after high school, and allowed us to actually have a very, very large number of students succeed. And I think that for this country, if we're constantly putting money first, we need to have a productive society, and we need to put the infrastructure and the supports in place to actually make that happen. Instead of actually saying, let's cut costs and then everything will be fine, it isn't. I think you're absolutely right. We do need a free education system. But in terms of health, we also need free primary health care for those who are disadvantaged with lower incomes or disabled, to make sure that those who need health care most get it when they should. I absolutely believe in that. And if we have to raise our taxes for those who can afford it, then so be it. I think that's the most important thing to do. And it is important, because when I talk about patient outcomes, I'm talking about things that can be avoided. So the more work a nurse has to do, the more likely there is to be patient harm. But if a nurse has just one less patient to look after, the research shows that patient mortality or death decreases by 7%, and so does the length of stay and harm that could be caused, like from weight, like pneumonia, falls, hospital-acquired infections. And so this is why we're calling for nurse-patient ratios. Once again, going back to tax, we need enough funds to make that happen. And it will actually reduce, if we have nurses who have adequate, fair, safe workloads, it will mean that the costs on the health system and on society in general will be much reduced. And we do need to look at it differently. Cutting costs is not the way to go.
Doesn't the Labour Party and other groups need to actually help people understand that if you have a proper tax system, a fair tax system, that you can, then you get things like good education, you get health care that you can afford. And if you don't have that, you don't get that. If you can't expect.
That's right. I do believe that there is a real understanding of that. However, I'm going to assume that governments make decisions based on a whole lot of competing priorities. And what those are, they certainly don't tell us. And I'm sure that I grew up in the 60s, and there was all of those things in place in society at that time. But I have to assume that big business and the ability of overseas investments have changed the face of our society. So money has become more important than people. And, you know, we've got a housing crisis, but we also all know that there's been a lot of land banking going on, and houses across the country are empty, where people are living in motels because they can't afford the rent or they can't find a house to live in. These are major, major issues, because, as I said earlier, a warm, dry house is very, very important to keeping a person or a family healthy. So these sorts of things have to actually be changed. And I'm not convinced at the moment that the coalition government is going to do that.
The coalition government, during the election, promised to complete the Dunedin Hospital according to the rebuild specifications. Do you think they will do that?
Yes. Yeah, I believe they will. One, because the building framework is already up there. There's a huge amount of work going on. But we do absolutely need to have our hospital built based on the original specifications, not the shifting goalposts that we've had over the last year or so. And that's important, because the plan for the hospital was based on a whole lot of consultation that was done with nurses, doctors and all the other health professionals that were there at the time. They had consultation groups where they talked through what was needed in any particular area. And let's remember that Dunedin Hospital is also a teaching and a teaching facility with the Otago University. And there was a huge outcry, I believe, when it was decided to save money that they were going to reduce or eliminate the areas where teaching and learning was going to be carried out. Once again, none of us could understand that. And but I think that, you know, it's not just about Dunedin Hospital. We have to have enough infrastructure within the whole health system throughout the nation that will provide the kind of care we need to actually stay well, rather than actually have lots of big hospitals to actually pick up the pieces because we're so sick that we have to go there. It is so much better if we don't get sick in the first place, we don't have accidents in the first place that make us need hospital. You know, we can talk about ACC. Recently, we've been told 350 jobs are going in ACC. Most of those are in the area where prevention is the focus. So this is a no-brainer. If we're going to actually stop people getting up on ladders or hurting themselves on the rugby field or doing other sports, or being careful with electricity or doing their renovations in their homes, we need to understand what that looks like. And we can only do that if we're actually taught to do it well.
It looks like Pike River.
Absolutely. Pike River is an absolute tragedy, but we learned a lot from it. Unfortunately, those lessons seem to be getting ignored now. The Health and Safety and Employment Act is a very good piece of legislation, and it lent itself to a developing WorkSafe, of course, that would work with the employees that were concerned about unsafe work environments and practices. Unfortunately, I don't believe, in my experience anyway, that WorkSafe has got the power to make sure that employees that raise concerns are actually heard and their concerns are acted on properly.
It's called white-handed regulation.
Course, yeah.
Where you depend on the employer to account. Well. I mean, the government expects the employer to regulate themselves, and they expect the employer will look after safety first and profit second. And that doesn't always happen.
No, it doesn't, because the employers got other issues. Like, they're being told that they have to cut costs. They have to actually stay within their budget before the end of the financial year. And if they've been told that by the government, how do they balance that against safe staffing? Very recently, Te Whatu Ora put out an email that you, or a communication that you may be aware of, telling the managers that they had to actually reduce any overtime. There was a ban on overtime, there still is, that sick leave wasn't to be replaced unless it was absolutely necessary. And on top of that, that staff should be encouraged to go on holiday. When I read that, I thought, well, who's going to be left to actually do the work on the floor? Because we're already understaffed. And people go sick because they're so stressed when they go to work and see that the workloads are, one, just totally unmanageable, and they don't have enough people to do the job properly. They get very, very stressed and they get sick because of that stress. And the managers, the clinical nurse managers, were being told to enforce this, despite the fact that it was going to increase the unsafe work conditions that the nurses were working in and the patients were coming into. It just didn't make any sense whatsoever.
When we're training nurses, what's the right balance between academic training and practical training in hospitals?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question because we've had a number of different approaches over the last few decades. When I became a nurse, we were using the apprenticeship model where we would be in class for 1 or 2 weeks, but most of our learning was done in practice with senior nurses teaching us. And then in the sort of mid-1990s, we swung over to educating nurses in universities and polytechs. And I absolutely agreed with that because it was important that nurses were able to provide evidence for what they did. And we needed to have a research evidence-based approach to our nursing practice. And it was important that all nurses understood what that meant so that we could provide the best care we could. But when a nurse student moved out of the apprenticeship system where they were paid for their clinical time, where they were given food and shelter in the nurse's home that was subsidised, the student nurses lost that pastoral care that was needed to make sure that most nurses completed their training and went on to be registered nurses. However, I'm very, very much aware that nurses in New Zealand now are absolutely sought after and valued overseas because our level of practice, our understanding of evidence-based practice, and our ability to critically think and advocate for our patients and also advocate for a better health system is one of the best in the world. And we need to be proud of that. But we cannot keep losing our students. A 1/3 attrition rate is just abysmal, and that has to change down to zero. So the balance of practice and theory is very, very important. Over the years, we've introduced an approach called simulation, where you can go into mock-up areas in the hospital, like a resus unit, and actually practice your skills and your knowledge in a safe work environment where no patient will get harmed. And that's really, really important because it allows us to learn how each person works and communicates. It allows us to safely critique each other's practice so that we can learn from each other. And it allows us to strengthen our teamwork and our ability to provide timely care, but it doesn't put us in the realities of practice. And the realities of practice, you're always being interrupted, you're always being asked to do more with less. And that's why it's very, very important that nurses and doctors have a good opportunity to learn in real practice in real time with senior nurses and doctors who can teach them. You can't divorce the realities of practice and hope that just because you've been able to practice your theory in a simulation unit that will be enough. You have to understand the realities of short staffing and few resources on the floor and how to actually manage those when you've got a very sick patient in front of you. So it is a very, very delicate balance. But I know that nurse tutors and senior consultants and registrars who do a lot of the teaching on the floor understand how that balance goes. And I think that we're doing all right in that area. The only thing that I would like to see is that our nurses, when they are on their clinical placements, our student nurses, that they are paid for that time so that they don't have the pressure of having to put petrol in the car and eat and pay their rent. It's taken away from them.
In other words, you think in the education system, particularly for nurses, the user pay system is failing, that we can't be expected to pay for our education while we're getting it, or we may not finish getting it.
Absolutely. But it's also inequitable, because I did mention earlier that male-dominated professions do get that support, whereas the female-dominated profession, nursing, does not. And questions need to be asked about that. Why is there that inequity? And I know that nursing is the largest health workforce, but that's no excuse. If we want the health system that we deserve to have, a health system that actually provides health rather than cure sickness, then we need to invest in it. And long term, that will mean that a healthier nation will have least health costs long term. And we need successive governments to agree and commit to making that happen.
Do you see the model of care needing changing? And do nurses on the floor have enough input into the model of care in hospitals and other health services?
Well, currently the model of care is a medical model, which is dominant. But I'm very much aware that a lot of doctors, nurses, social workers, physiotherapists, the ambulance service, aged care, everybody knows that we can't keep doing what we're doing now because it's not working. We're just the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. What we need to do is have a real strong fence at the top of the cliff to stop people getting ill in the first place. And that's why the PIORA Act absolutely has the aspirations of making that happen. But it requires investment, funding. It requires more nurses, more doctors, more healthcare professionals. It requires us to think about how we do that differently. I mentioned earlier that I'm a big fan of how Māori and Pacifica communities work together to make those sorts of things, having a healthy community, healthy families, healthy individuals, work. They don't focus on the individual. They focus on what is the best for the community. And those go back to the things that I mentioned before. Instead of focusing on spending billions and billions of dollars on medications to help people who are already sick, we should be spending billions of dollars on having healthy, dry homes for all, education free for all, free primary health care, health, and financial support to grow our own health professionals in New Zealand. These are no-brainer, and if we have to put the taxes up, so be it. But in New Zealand, I believe that most of us want the best for each other, for our neighbours, our families, our communities. And if we can change the tax system to actually fund this, we would go back to once again having the best health system in the world and being one of the healthiest nations in the world. And that I hope to live to see in my lifetime.
I hope so too. I've been hoping that for a long time. And I hope to, it'll have to be a shorter time for me than for you if I'm going to see it while I'm alive. But thanks for being on air, and thanks for having a hopeful vision of the future, a hopeful vision of what New Zealand could become again. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, Marvin, for talking to me. I really appreciate it. Take care.
Take care. You too.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.